Hello, and welcome to the Earth Trust podcast. In this episode, we hear from the Dig Ventures archaeology team as they share with us the latest fascinating stories being revealed by the findings unearthed at Whitnam Clumps, as we continue to learn more about the people who have lived in this landscape throughout history. Dig Ventures excavated a site around Earth Trust headquarters at the foot of Whitnam Clumps in 2019 to 21. What they uncovered was a vast Iron Age settlement. Among the many objects found was a remarkably intact tuyere. Exactly what it is, its significance, and the story it brings to light is fascinating, as the team who discovered it share with us now.
Hi, I'm Maya, and I'm Director of Engagement at Dig Ventures.
Hi, I'm Nat. I'm Project Officer with Dig Ventures, and I led the excavations at the Earth Trust.
And that was a couple of years ago now, wasn't it, Nat?
Yeah, it was.
So there's been quite a big gap since obviously the dig was actually executed. And so we had the first findings that we were able to really share with people was back in the autumn of 2022, and that was the tiny dog remains. So we're now really pleased to be able to share another significant find on the site. So are you able to tell us, maybe Maya, just introduce a little bit about that find and why it's so significant?
Yeah, absolutely. It's really quite a stunning find. So just as a little bit of background to the site to help put it in context, Nat and the team were out in the field digging just downslope from Whitnam Clumps and the hill fort there, and they uncovered 15 roundhouses and dating back to the Iron Age and Bronze Age, and then also a later Roman villa on top of that. So they'd found quite a substantial settlement downslope from the hill fort. And then after sort of months and years of excavation, all of that material went back to the lab and was analysed. And that's when we discovered that not only was there a settlement, but there was what we think is a blacksmith's workshop dating back to the very early days of ironworking in the UK.
And can you elaborate a little bit more on the specific find that we're sort of sharing with people and why it's so significant, why you're so excited about it?
It's quite a spectacular set of finds. So the workshop itself basically is the footprint of a roundhouse. We didn't actually know what the roundhouse was being used for until our specialists took a closer look at some of the things that were found inside of it. And that's where they identified some really, really interesting things that we're going to talk about in a minute. The main one really is what looks like a giant polo is the best way I can describe it. Imagine like a polo the size of two of your hands with a hole going through it. And on site, the team didn't really know what it was, knew it was something fascinating. But when it was taken back to the lab, that's where the specialist identified it as a tuyere, which is basically the component that would connect bellows to a blacksmith's hearth. It's the bit that allows air to be channeled through, but also protects the bellows from the heat of the flames, because the flames would reach temperatures like 1500 degrees and bellows would be made of, you know, wood and leather and can easily burn. So you need something to protect them from the heat. And that's what we found.
And Nat, can you tell us a little bit about how sort of the moment of discovery when you're doing the excavation? I think, you know, Maya, you said then that you're not always clear what some of these finds actually are at the time, but can you remember finding this piece?
Well, funnily enough, I can, because I didn't personally find it. One of my colleagues, Ben, found it, but he was like, I've got something really weird. I don't know what it is. I think it might be a mould or something, is what we initially thought it was. And it was in amongst a bunch of broken up pottery, in this sort of terminus of, or this bit of a ring gully, ring ditch, that we'd been excavating and didn't know what it was. And then it was when it was lifted and we were looking at it and it's like, it's got a hole in it. What is this thing? And then I remember getting the email from the specialist saying, like, he was really excited by it. And it's like, you've got a tuyere. And it's like, what is that?
Oh, what?
And then And he was like, yeah, this is like unique, or not unique, but really, really, really rare for an early Iron Age. And then that meant that we went and see radiocarbon dated that context and got some good dates that like made it slap bang in the early Iron Age, like sort of 8th to 6th century, which is really, really cool.
So in what ways did this workshop expand our understanding of the early days of ironworking in the UK? Is it changing thinking, or is it validating stuff that we knew, archaeologists knew, but haven't got the physical evidence of?
Yeah, it's telling us quite a lot, to be honest, because so ironworking only really arrived in Britain around 800 BC. And like Nat just said, the radiocarbon dates that we got from the site is 771 to 515 BC. So we're literally looking at the first few decades and centuries of ironworking arriving in Britain. So it is a really, really early blacksmith. And one of the most important things about it really is that the only evidence really we have of metalworking from that period in this country, most of them are the smelting sites. So the sites where the metal is being made, converted from the iron ore into iron. What we haven't really gotten, what is extra rare, are the sites where that metal was then turned into artifacts. So where the blacksmiths were forging artifacts, and to see the craftsperson at work rather than the people who are extracting the metal. So this site is really putting that on the map. So it's really contributing to the sort of timeline of evidence that we've got across the country for how blacksmithing actually began in this country and how it's developed. So it's that in itself is quite extraordinary. But I think the thing that we're all super excited about is what the 2 year is telling us as well. So it's not just that this is a really crucial piece of evidence that rarely survives and like a really crucial component of the hearth. The size of it is kind of curious. It's quite large, or it's larger than you would expect for a hearth. And that in itself suggests that the hearth was bigger than normal. Now that might not sound super exciting at first, but when we start to think about what that really means, things get just really, really exciting from this point onwards. So in the Iron Age, most artifacts were quite small, you know, everyday items, tools, things that you're using, most of them are quite small, and that only requires quite a small hearth to produce them. So then why on earth is there this larger than usual hearth? You don't want a hearth that's bigger than you need, because it takes lots of fuel, it's hard to control, you don't want too much oxygen going in. Yes, oxygen increases temperature, but it then also can, if you have too much, then it kind of destroys the metal, it gets oxidized. It's not what you want as a blacksmith. The only reason as a blacksmith that you would want a larger than normal hearth is because you are making something that is larger than normal. And in the Iron Age, that can only be one of a very few things. So that could either be trade bars, the really high quality iron that is used for trading iron, which in itself is quite difficult to produce, but it could also be something like a sword or a cart or chariot wheel. And those are really the only things that are large that get produced in this period. And those wouldn't be produced by your normal or your average village blacksmith. Those are difficult things to produce. They're not day-to-day items. They're not things that are easy to repair or to make. The only people that would be making that kind of thing are someone who is extremely skilled, extremely experienced, and has a specialized setup, the kind of gear and the kit and the experience and the assistance required to make those extremely special and extremely complicated objects. One of the first things that you can see was the footprint of the building itself, and you can see that it's a circular structure, so you know it's a roundhouse. But one of the main things that was different about it from a normal roundhouse where somebody would have lived is where the door was and the way that you would get people in and light into the structure. So in a normal roundhouse, you want in as much light as you can get because you want to be able to see what you're doing inside. But for a smithy, actually you want it to be quite dark, because what you want to be able to see is the colour of the flame and of the iron that you're working with. And that gives you a lot of information about, you know, the temperature, the heat, the condition of it, and what you need to do next. And what you can see in the layout of this roundhouse is that the door is on the other side and that there are structures there to try and limit the amount of light coming in. just really, really interesting when you think about it. It's kind of, it's almost sort of the opposite of how you'd expect it to be. You'd expect there to be lots of light, but there isn't. And the other thing as well is that it's slightly separated from the rest of the settlement. And that kind of perhaps tells us a little bit about how the community would have seen the blacksmith. So perhaps one reason that it's separated is because it's, you know, a health and safety nightmare, and you don't want to accidentally set the rest of the village on fire. But at the same time, it might also tell us something about how the smith is seen, because it's quite a powerful thing. Like, you know, the knowledge to do it would have been carefully controlled. And the people who didn't really know much about it, it would have seemed like maybe it required special powers or involved magic, or was quite transformative. Like the smith would have been seen as someone who had special, maybe even divine knowledge. And that kind of separation of the smithy from the rest of the settlement might be a reflection of that.
And another thing that's really interesting about the placement of the smithy is it seems to be slightly later than the earliest stuff that's happening around the Hillfort. So we've got this massive ditch that goes past it on one side, and it's just late. It's later than that. So the ring gullies, the ring ditches associated with Roundhouse, are cutting through that. So we know that it's later than that, but it's still very early. So one of the things that we can think about is that this Hillfort is created, and it's sort of bringing these elite people to it. It's like this beacon, and it brings people who want to ply their trade, do their master smithy in, and so it's kind of
it's drawing people to it.
Yeah, it's drawing yeah. people in.
Yeah, it's like a magnet.
Okay, I was going to ask about that, is whether somebody this highly skilled, is it likely that they would have learnt, you know, sort of in situ, but it sounds like they've probably come from elsewhere with those skills.
Yeah,
and a lot of the structures, I think, in blacksmithing, they could almost be portable to some extent. Like if the blacksmith decided to move, they would take the things that are valuable and take them with them. And that's actually a really interesting thing to mention, is that the one thing we didn't find from the blacksmith was their tools. So we found everything else. We found the structure, we found the hearth lining, we found the hammer scale, the waste from actually hitting and hammering the metal into shape. And we found the tool, we found all of these elements, almost the complete workshop. The only thing that we didn't find was the tools. Now, why on earth would that be? Probably because they're really valuable and you wouldn't want to leave them behind. So if they did move on, they would have taken them with them. And actually, there's a little bit of evidence that suggests that in the end, the workshop was quite carefully dismantled, and some of the waste and the, you know, bits of broken hearth lining and all of that were sort of pushed into a ring ditch and sort of carefully covered over, and the ground levelled out again. So we don't know why the blacksmith would have left or what quite happened there. But yeah, I think the fact that we didn't find the tools suggests that they left in good terms and not in a hurry, and took the things that they needed with them.
Is there any evidence of the things they made? Have you found any of that on site?
No, not. We found actually very little in the way of Iron Age metalwork. Most of it was in the form of nails. It's fairly, but it's because the stuff that they were making, like their tools, was special. It's not something like, you're not going to leave your sword lying around.
So it would have traveled with the people who then took ownership of those items. And yes, especially if it's wheels, you need those to be going from one place to the other.
And it also tells us something about the range and levels of blacksmithing that are happening. So just like today, you would have a hierarchy of blacksmiths. You'd have your local village smiths, where you'd go and get things fixed, your day-to-day tools fixed. You'd have your sort of mid-range blacksmith, who you might go to get your specialist tools. And then you'd have these extremely professional elite or master blacksmiths who can produce the things that are really complicated and difficult. And perhaps you're also the people teaching and passing on knowledge to others in the community as well.
So that suggests that whoever the blacksmith who was using this tool may have been training others or may have been well known as somebody with particularly elite skills.
Potentially, yeah. It's quite exciting when you start to think about it, really, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and it's amazing, isn't it, how it's an object that you know is used in a certain way, but then you can start to build up the picture of the person behind the object, I guess, and the community around it. So I was going to ask about whether there's anything more that you can elaborate around the significance of discovering an Iron Age settlement, including the roundhouses near the blacksmith's workshop, and also some of those other findings that have been discovered on site that suggest ceremonial activities or other kinds of things that happened. So Nat, did you want to expand on that?
I think it's just bringing together a really nice, rich, a diverse nature of what early Iron Age sites would be like, right? It's not just a bunch of people living in roundhouses then building a hill fort. It's like they've got all of these belief systems that they're doing. So for example, one thing that was really crazy and weird that we found, it's slightly later in date, was this dog skull buried in a pit with two cow skulls. And there is no real reason for that, other than some sort of ritual. I can't think of anything, any other reason for it. And then there's a giant, like a quite a nice settlement. There's probably sort of five or six roundhouses at any one time going on. So, and that's only in the portion of the site that we've excavated. There's almost certainly many more in the area as well. And there's been more found previously. So there's a it's a good sized little hamlet around the castle hill, the hill fort. And the hill fort had its origins in the Bronze Age. And so it's clearly an important site over the last sort of 2,000-4,000 years. And it just sort of ties together and it brings sort of focus of the landscape. It's clearly been a focus of the landscape, and that's bringing the elite people to it and bringing everyone to that focal point, just in that nice little bend in the Thames, really.
Yeah.
I think it's an incredible site.
I guess it's also, I mean, now you can still clearly see the significance of the site just across the landscape, because it's so visually apparent from a distance, the two hills, the two clumps, and then also, like you said, the proximity to the river, and it's easy even now to imagine the visual, to place yourself in what it might have looked like thousands of years ago as well, isn't it?
And I think, like you say, you can see, you know, loads of people visit the clumps, don't they? People go for walks, they go with their family, bring their dogs. It's a really visual landmark in the landscape. And it would have been the same then, just as visible. But what we can't see today is all of the stuff that's just under your feet. And that's what's been, I think, so remarkable about this excavation and what it's revealing is, yes, we can see this hill fort and people still enjoy it today, but all of those stories of the people back then that used that hill fort and for who that was also an iconic monument, their stories are, you know, they're only a few, it's only a few centimetres under the ground. And if you know how to dig and a part of an excavation, we can really start to reveal the stories of the people that were living there at the time. And it's pretty magical, I think.
And that speaks so perfectly to what Earth Trust, you know, is all about, is that connection between people and nature and people and their surroundings. And it's so, you know, easy to see ourselves as separate from those places, but we're so entrenched. It's such a, you know, an ecosystem. So it's a real reminder of that, isn't it? But do you know, is there a sort of are you able to tell whether there's like a continuous link or an evidence of there being humans in this space with some kind of settlement from the earliest time up to, you know, up to now? Or are there gaps where we can't quite tell what may have happened?
There's pretty much, yeah, there is continuous occupation in that landscape. We didn't find very much in the way of Bronze Age. There was more found in previous excavations, especially near Castle Hill. And we suspect that that Bronze Age settlement is further south of where we were excavating.
Right.
And then into the Iron Age, there was a lot of activity in the early and the middle Iron Ages. But in the late Iron Age, there was a bit of a lull. People seem to have moved away. And that's probably because they're moving away to sites like Dyke Hills over the river. It's a big Iron Age. Late Iron Age 4 fortified settlement there, and that seems to be a general pattern in the landscape. And then we've got the Romans turn up, and we've got some burials that date to the late Roman, early medieval, sort of 5th-6th century. So there's continual occupation till then, and then from about the 6th century onwards it turned into agricultural land.
And right, so then there's less kind of artifacts because obviously it's used in a different way. Yeah.
But we still get signs of that activity. We've got furrows across the site showing their farming, and we'll find random bits of medieval pottery and maybe a bit of clay pipe and things like that. So we do still get that. And then the farm comes along. Yeah, there's occupation for
constantly
3,000-4,000 years. It's very cool.
It really is, yeah. So I was going to ask, we've got some opportunities for people to see and to learn more about the things that we've found so far, and then a really exciting opportunity coming up in May. So I thought let's talk first about the Festival of Discovery. So that's mid-February, between on February the 17th to the 18th. So what, can you tell us a little bit about what's going to happen during that Festival of Discovery, what people who come can expect to see and experience?
Shout out to Nat and his team in the field, who found about 15,000 artifacts during the dig.
Wow.
Just loads and loads and loads. So what we're doing is we're having a pop-up exhibition at the Earth Trust Centre, which will be a chance to see some of those 15,000 artifacts. Obviously not all of them, because that would be huge. But a very curated selection of our favourite ones from the Bronze Age, Iron Age and Roman periods, including the famous Tuya. That will be on display, so people will be able to come and see the artifacts for themselves. And then we'll be having a series of live talks with some of the specialists who have done the analysis. They'll be telling us more about what they've discovered and giving us some insights. And there'll be lots of opportunities to ask questions as well in the Q&A at the end. And then for those who really want to actually get hands-on with some of the artifacts and learn how specialists actually identify and analyse them, we're running a series of workshops that you can book onto as well. So things like how to study animal bones, how to study human remains, or even how to make your own prehistoric pot inspired by some of the finds. So there's a whole range of things that people can come along and try over the 17th and 18th of February.
Fantastic. And we had a festival last summer that was a sort of very family focused one. So are you expecting, is this for all ages, or sort of what kind of level of interest and understanding is this pitched at?
So this festival is aimed more at adults. Basically, we had a lot of adults coming along to the family festival with their kids saying, oh, I'd love there to be an adult version of this for grown-ups. And so that's pretty much what this is. So the exhibition, the talks and the workshops are all aimed at adults. However, I'd say they are, you know, young adult and teenage friendly as well. So if you've got children who, you know, love a bit of history, they're more than welcome to come along and have a look as well. I think it'd be right up their street too.
Fantastic. And then the next really exciting thing that's going to happen after February is maybe to find some more things. So so can you tell us a little bit about what's going to happen in May?
So we've been crowdfunding to do another dig Because like Nat hinted at earlier, actually we've only uncovered a fraction of the site. So as well as the Iron Age settlement, Nat mentioned that we'd also found a Roman villa that was later built on top of the remains of the Iron Age village. So we think that's one area that we'd like to go back to and explore a little bit more of. So we've been crowdfunding a dig to do that. And people who are crowdfunding the dig will be able to come and take part along with us, and will be led and guided by Nat and his team in how to dig and unearth remains themselves. And there will also be a programme of guided tours and other events alongside the dig, so that people from the area can come and see more about the dig and see it in action and get to meet the team as well.
The excitement and the significance of those findings are really coming across as both of you talk. So, which I think is, yeah, is why for people, you know, I think gives people a glance of what they will be able to get when they come and speak to you in February, that sort of excitement and passion. So as we're, you know, looking at these amazing artifacts and really feeling that excitement, what do you think are the key takeaways about our history and the skills of early craftsmen?
I think for me, it is the sheer level of skill that is involved in this, and the fact that, you know, blacksmithing was fundamental to pretty much everything that else that happened in that period. And it's, you know, it's a very, archaeology is almost like the history of human innovation, and that's literally what we can see here. We can see basically the arrival of blacksmithing in Britain and one of the first master blacksmiths to be practicing in the region, and you can really start to picture how they were viewed by the surrounding community as well. And, you know, another thing I was thinking about is like, what's an equivalent to this? It's like, you know, we can all bake cupcakes. If you're a baker, yes, everyone can bake cupcakes. But are you someone who could bake a 10-tiered wedding cake that doesn't collapse and tastes delicious as well? And that's basically what one of these blacksmiths are. You know, they're someone who is at the top of their game and can do something that very few other people can do.
Yeah, no, that is really exciting. And Nat, is there anything from you, any kind of takeaway that Maya hasn't mentioned?
In a really geeky way, one of my key takeaways is like just how important the postex is. Digging is only like it's scratching the surface. Maybe 50% of the work is digging, and then the other 50% all happening in the postex. And you learn
post excavation, like, I guess. Is that
yeah. So in the post-excavation process, if we hadn't done this analysis, we wouldn't have learned all of this stuff. To me, it's like how important the whole process is and how everything works together. And it's just really cool.
That, yeah. And there's more to come as well, isn't there? More findings that we haven't, you know, sort of told people about yet. And presumably they will be able to find out about when they come in February. So yeah, that there's a lot of post-excavation findings or conclusion that are very exciting about this site. So thank you so much, Nat and Maya. I really appreciate you giving us your time and and for sharing so eloquently, you know, sort of why these finds are so exciting. And yeah, hope that people will be as excited as we are and come along to meet you both in February.
Really, really, really looking forward to it. Can't wait.
Yeah, it's going to be fun. It's going to be a good weekend.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much.
After only 4 months of archaeological investigations, we'd never expected to find such a significant Iron Age and Roman settlement here. We know this area is special, and clearly our ancestors did too. With so many layers of time beneath our feet and so many lives having been lived out in this special place, it's our time now to share and bring this knowledge to life for all our visitors.